Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 271, Happy the Movie, with noted film director Rocco Bellick. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I was 18 years old, and I was there with a group of college students who had raised money for refugees of the Mozambican Civil War. And we had headed down to a refugee camp just outside of Mozambique, where people who had suffered through this war were struggling to survive. Now, these are people who had been terrorized. Some of them had had their arms cut off, their lips cut off, their noses cut off, just horribly brutalized. And I was very prepared on that trip, or I was trying to prepare myself before going, to see extreme suffering and struggle, hardship, and I was trying to edify myself to be able to face that. And what I saw instead on this trip was people who were completely alive. They were vibrant, and they were enthusiastic, and they were curious, and they were laughing and dancing and smiling. And it totally blew me away that people who had struggled and suffered so much could have such a sense of, joie de vivre, with such a sense of life and happiness.
That was the voice of my guest, Rocco Bellick, speaking about a formative experience in the chain of life events that led to his exploration of positive psychology and the creation of his new feature-length documentary, Happy. Director Rocco Bellick is co-founder of Wadi Rum Productions in Los Angeles and was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary for his first feature film with Wadi Rum, the acclaimed Genghis Blues. Rocco Bellick started making films in the third grade with his brother, Adrian Bellick, and a friend of theirs, Christopher Nolan, who borrowed a Super 8 movie camera from his parents and started experimenting with the surreality of film. Heavily influenced by Star Wars, the young team experimented with special effects. Later, because his mother used a wrench to lock their TV, Rocco became enchanted with programs through which he could explore the world. His first movie, Genghis Blues, in 1999, was made on a shoestring budget using home video cameras and was nominated for an Academy Award. Bellick recently directed the 44-minute documentary Dreams, Cinema of the Subconscious, which was released on the Inception Blu-ray. For his current project, Bellick teamed up with Hollywood heavyweight Tom Shadyac of Liar Liar and Bruce Almighty, who executive produced, directed the feature film Happy. Happy combines powerful human stories from around the world with cutting-edge science to give us a deeper understanding of our most valued emotion. Now, here's the interview. Rocco Bellick, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm so excited to have this opportunity to speak with you about your films, both your earlier success with Genghis Blues and your new one, Happy the Movie. I noticed in your bio that you got interested in shooting film at a very early age. So let's start there and have you tell us about that.
Sure. Well, when I was about 5 or 6 years old, a friend of mine named Chris Nolan, who people know from things like The Dark Knight and Batman Begins and Inception, he directed those films. But at the time, we were just 6-year-olds running around the suburb of Chicago, and his father gave him a old Super 8 movie camera to sort of experiment with. And Chris made a few films way back when.
Amazing.
Yeah, absolutely, exactly. Now, when you connect the dots, you look backwards and you connect the dots, you realize that that gesture and that trust by his father led to a lot of amazing things. So I didn't really know what I was doing. I just sort of helped Chris here and there as an extra. Chris and my older brother were friends. And so they made these films, and somehow over the years, I felt that I had made films, even though it wasn't really true. When I got into junior high school, when it came time to do a creative science project, I asked the teacher if I could make a film about the subject. And they said, sure, and so I made a terrible short film that didn't make any sense. But again, I had this, I had crossed the psychological barrier that I could do it. And then in college, I made a few short films, and then the first real film that I spent a lot of energy on is a movie called Genghis Blues that ended up, it took me about 4 years to make. I started it as soon as I got out of college, and then one day we found ourselves walking down the red carpet at the Oscars with an Academy Award nomination, which was a huge surprise, because as I said, I'd never really made a coherent film up to that point. But I spent a lot of effort, and luckily people responded to it.
Yes. Well, when you were in college, did you end up going to film school?
No, I went to UCSB, which is University of California in Santa Barbara, and I studied art. So I studied photography and painting and drawing and all that fun stuff that I loved doing when I was a kid, but always in the back of my head knowing that that this might lead me towards film. But I wanted to explore these other mediums first, because again, I sort of had this confidence that if I wanted to, I could always get into film. And indeed, I did take a lot of film classes at school, and I made a few films. And I traveled around the world for a year. I took a year and a half off of school, and I painted houses and saved some money. And during that trip, that was really when I shot, I would say, my first film, which was simply a travelogue of that journey around the world. And that was my first experience really editing a long-form project.
And that was probably before a lot of the tools that are available now.
Exactly. That was we basically had two videotape decks connected to a third tape deck, and you would press, you know, play on one and record on the other, and you would just get pieces of it that way. So it's called linear editing, where you had to really make the right decisions the first time around. Genghis Blues, I was very fortunate to have access to an extremely expensive editing system, which is sort of the basis of what everybody's using nowadays, a nonlinear editing system called Avid at the time. And that enabled you to look at bits and pieces of footage from all over the place and mix and match. And that's sort of the reason why I love doing this, is that it's creative all the way through. You know, the editing is a really, really fun process where you get to look at what you did and find the best way to tell that story.
Yeah. I've heard of Avid too. So you mentioned Genghis Blues, and I have to say that's one of my all-time favorites and most unforgettable documentaries. How did that film come about?
Oh, wow. Well, first of all, that's great to hear. I appreciate that. When I was 16 years old, my mom told me that I had to come and watch a documentary on TBS. Now, she used to do that all the time. She would literally interrupt me doing my homework and say, there's something really fascinating on TV, you have to watch it, which is kind of the opposite of what many people think parents should do. But she was always steering me towards really important and fascinating programs. And one of them was about an eccentric physicist named Richard Feynman, who had won a Nobel Prize in physics, and who was who had sort of made his name as one of the youngest people working on the atomic bomb.
Sure.
A kind of a genius character, but who also played bongo drums and did all kinds of eccentric things. This film was about him, but not about him as a scientist. It was about him trying to get to this place that he knew about from collecting postage stamps when he was a kid, this very kind of far-off place near Mongolia called Tanutuva. And it was kind of a Shangri-La where people still possibly lived in teepees and hunted animals with bows and arrows. And it really captured Feynman's imagination. And as an adult, he rekindled that interest and tried to get there, only to discover that it was safe and sound, secure behind the Iron Curtain. The Soviet Union had absorbed it, and it was off limits to foreigners, especially Americans. So this documentary was gave the account of how Feynman and his friend spent 13 years trying to get there and didn't make it. So I immediately decided, okay, I'm 16 years old. At some point, I'm going to make it. Feynman didn't make it. I'm going to go. And as I mentioned, I traveled around the world, and I didn't get there then. It was very hard to cross the border into Tuva. But I met a gentleman who was Feynman's sidekick. Now, Feynman passed away. I met a gentleman who I'd seen in the film. I called him up, and I said, hey, I want to go to Tuva when I get out of college. I'm just about to graduate, and if I go, I'm going to bring a video camera, but there's no information about Tuva, and this is just before the Internet kind of started happening. And I said, you're the only guy who knows anything about Tuva. You know, I just thought you should know that that's what I'm going to do. And he told me about a blind American blues musician who taught himself to do a kind of singing that comes only from this area, where people sing up to three notes at the same time. And this blues guy had played with John Lee Hooker and B.B. King, and he was about to go for a competition of what they call throat singing in Tuva that summer. And he said, if my friend at the BBC doesn't shoot the film of his trip over there, maybe you could do it. And I realized he was referring to the filmmaker who made the movie that inspired me in the first place. And I realized that he had no idea that I didn't know what I was doing. So I kind of pretended to be busy, and I said, well, I'll see if I can fit it into my schedule. I got off the phone, and I immediately started working towards that goal. And 4 years later, we were finished with the film, and we premiered it at the Sundance Film Festival.
How remarkable, and what a testimonial for Joseph Campbell's recommendation that one follow their bliss.
Yeah.
And it's so fascinating, these thin threads in a way. I mean, you know, when they were making that film about Richard Feynman, I mean, certainly he didn't know what effect that was going to have, you know, and nobody involved in making that film knew that there would be this young boy who would happen to see it and who would get inspired. And it's just amazing the way we impact one another with these kind of spider webs of meaning, of unanticipated meaning.
It's absolutely right. I was lucky enough to interview Howard Zinn, who, as many people know, wrote a book called The People's History of the United States.
Yes.
And is considered by many to be the greatest historian in America. He's also very controversial because he takes these alternative perspectives of history from the side, let's say, of not necessarily of the people who won in history. And so I asked Mr. Zinn if there is any morsel of truth, if there's any kind of single gem of wisdom that he's gleaned over, you know, his 60 or 70 years of studying history and social revolutions and political movements that we don't know that we should know. And he said, yeah, there is. I thought he was going to say, no, it's too complicated. But he said, there is. There's one thing that we do not recognize, the power of our own voice, of our singular voice. He said, we often feel overwhelmed that things are out of our control and that bigger powers really make the world go round. But he said, think of all the things, of the important things that you have done in your life, the important decisions you've made. He said, if you really trace them back, you can often trace them to a single conversation or a single billboard that you read or a story that you read or some single voice, you know, from your friend or your mother. And I immediately realized exactly that with the story that you just said, which is I saw this documentary. I called Ralph Layton, who was Feynman's friend, and if it wasn't for that phone call and for that film, I literally wouldn't be talking to you right now.
Yeah, it's just mind-blowing. Now, the blind blues singer was a fellow named Paul Penna, is that right?
Yes.
And he went on to enter a competition there in Tuva. You so well document that the people were so happy to encounter somebody from the West. I think they hardly ever saw anybody from the West. And here was somebody who'd gone to the trouble to learn this very difficult technique of throat singing. And he entered a competition. I don't recall if he won or not.
Well, that's you have a great memory. That's right. Paul, the story of Genghis Blues is really Paul's journey to Tuva for this competition. And in America, although Paul had played with these great musicians like B.B. King and John Lee Hooker and T-Bone Walker, in America he was really down and out, and his career hadn't quite ever gotten over that threshold where it became easy for him. And he was blind. And actually, the way that he discovered Tuvan throat singing is when he was trying to distract himself from the pain of realizing that his wife was dying of kidney failure. And it was something that happened over the course of many months. And late at night, Paul would tune into the shortwave radio. And again, you know, this single thread of, like you said, of communication that can change somebody's life. Paul heard one broadcast of this throat singing and recorded it, and then spent 10 years listening to that same tape over and over and over again, and teaching himself how to do this multi-harmonic singing technique.
Incredible. Incredible. Yeah,
absolutely. Amazing. I mean, this is a guy in a small apartment in San Francisco, fairly unknown. If you saw him walking down the street, you would think he was homeless. And he looked fairly disheveled, but extremely talented person. I mean, extremely talented. He had written a song called Jet Airliner, which the Steve Miller Band had made famous. And on Paul's first album, there's people like Merle Saunders and Jerry Garcia. So he's a very high-caliber musician. He just somehow fell into relative obscurity. And so as he went to Tuva, not only had they never really seen a Westerner sing their music, but he even learned the lyrics. Now, he didn't necessarily know what they meant, but he pronounced them perfectly. And on top of that, then he did learn some of the Tuvan language, just enough that that people were absolutely blown away. And so, you know, seeing him on stage with this kind of crooked afro and a steel guitar from, you know, Mississippi Delta Blues guitar, and speaking in their language, it was just a truly amazing event that I'm extremely fortunate to have witnessed. You know, from a few feet away as I was standing on stage shooting.
Yes.
Incredible.
Now, did he win the contest? I'm trying to remember.
Well, so there was different categories, and yes, Paul won the audience favorite award.
I bet.
Now, you can imagine there's people who rode horses for dozens, if not hundreds of miles around to enter this competition. And the Tuvan people are an extremely gracious and they're extremely good hosts, and they really made Paul feel welcome. And so in these different categories of different styles of singing, Paul was among what they call the laureates, which is one of the few people who sort of gained a master status in a style called Kargara, which is a very deep style. Deep sounds like an earthquake or a bullfrog with a whistle in his throat. And he was one of the laureates in that, and he won the audience favorite award.
Amazing, amazing. I was thrilled to be able to attend a couple of events here in the Bay Area where I got to see some of those Tuvan throat singers from the film perform.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How about you? Did you learn to do the Tuvan throat singing?
Well, you know, it's funny. Many people have said to me after they have seen the film that that they cannot resist trying to throat sing. And I did it usually in the shower or in the car.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of irresistible to just see if you can do it. And I wouldn't say I ever gained any proficiency, but the exciting truth is, despite the fact that some people thought it may be a genetic trait that only these Tuvans had the ability to do, despite that idea, it's not true, and it is a learnable and teachable skill. The advantage that the Tuvans have, of course, over most people is that they learn it from infancy, and they actually hear throat singing from before they're born. And many of the lullabies are multi-harmonic lullabies, which are absolutely beautiful and haunting and enchanting. So that's sort of the advantage that the Tuvans have, but there are many Westerners who have since then gained proficiency.
Well, I was surprised to learn that. I actually went to, believe it or not, a didgeridoo camp.
Oh, wow.
for about over a weekend, I think it was, or maybe a little bit longer. And among the various classes that they had there, there was a class on Tuvan throat singing. Unfortunately, I didn't take it. And then there's a fellow who teaches at Sonoma State University who teaches shamanic sorts of things, and I recently learned that he's pretty good at it. He can do it as well.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what's interesting. The same way that Paul combined Delta blues with Tuvan throat singing, something that the Tuvans were really excited about because there's something very kindred in the fact that they're both really folk music,
mm-hmm.
and there's a resonance there despite the fact that the folks are, you know, 10,000 miles apart.
Yeah.
What's really interesting now is that more and more people are combining throat singing with different styles, of music, and it's really expanding and stretching the art form.
I haven't encountered that, but I'll have to keep alert for that. Now, I have the impression that you named your film company Wadi Rum. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, Wadi Rum. Wadi Rum.
And what does that mean, and did it come from that part of the world?
Well, it actually is related to a conversation I had with Chris Nolan, which is that while we were in college, he visited the Middle East with his girlfriend at the time, and he was describing a place in the desert that was truly enchanting to him, where the light was all kind of orange and red and pink because the sunsets were super long and the dust was in the air, and along these expanses of sandy desert, they would be defined by these extremely tall and steep cliffs on either side. So you were in this kind of a cavern, but this gigantic cavern that stretched for miles and miles. And the cliffs were made of sandstone, and the sandstone had eroded, and the shapes looked like figures and skulls eroded into the sides of these cliffs. And then in the distance, you might see a few figures in a mirage.
Wow.
You weren't sure if they were floating, if they were real or not. And these were the Bedouins, who were the only people who lived there, these nomadic shepherds. And it was just a magical place that he described. And when I asked him what it was called, he said Wadi Rum. And you know, related to Genghis Blues and Tuva, I sort of thought of it as a kind of a Shangri-La that I have to reach someday. And so I just thought as a point to aspire to. It was a beautiful destination. And I did end up there. A few years later, I thought I was going to get eaten by wild dogs, but then we spent a couple nights in the desert, and it was absolutely incredible and worth all the attention that I was giving it.
Wow, what a life you've been leading. Now, as you mentioned, Genghis Blues was nominated for an Oscar. I assume that you must have been surprised by the film's success. I mean, you didn't set out thinking, I'm going to make an Oscar-worthy film.
Well, correct, not at all. It was a huge shock. What happened instead is when we started to learn about the process of making a real documentary and learning about fundraising and trying to get sponsors or investors or contributors and donors, I started to realize that there was no support for the film because essentially nobody stepped forward for about 3 years except for a small handful of people, including Feynman's friend who told me about Paul in the first place. His name is Ralph Layton. So Ralph and his family and a few other people helped me very, very sincerely and greatly. But for the most part, we could not find any organization or institute that would help fund the project.
I could see that would be a hard sell. You know, we have this blind guy who's a folk singer, and he's learned to do this esoteric kind of singing that nobody's ever heard of, and he wants to be in a contest in
exactly.
The outer reaches of Mongolia.
That's right, and you've never heard of him, and actually you've never really heard of his place, but I swear it's going to be really good.
Yeah.
It just didn't work, especially from two filmmakers, my brother and I, who had never done anything professionally. So it didn't surprise me. It was a little bit disappointing. I thought, oh God, you know, I guess we're going to make this film and then have to get a real job afterwards. So because of that lack of support making the film, I didn't expect that there would be any interest. And a lot of people had said, you know, we can't fund this because nobody's going to want to see it. They essentially said that, or we're not going to invest because nobody's going to want to buy tickets to see it. And in fact, the movie was theatrically released and it played in something like 15 or 20 countries. And film festivals all over the world. And it was a great success in my eyes, and I feel extremely fortunate that that happened. But you're right, when we were nominated for an Academy Award, it was just like, it didn't make any sense. It was a shock. And and I'm sure that we were the least well-funded production at the Oscars that year. We heard that you could not show up at the red carpet unless you're in a traditional limousine. We had some ideas of how to gain some publicity without spending much money, and we thought maybe we could somehow find a couple of camels, some Asian camels that we could ride up to the red carpet, and that would surely get some, you know, get us in some magazine somewhere to help the film out. But they said, no, you have to come up in a limousine. So through some friends of friends and my brother's college roommate, we got a couple of limousines that were kind of apparently had been sitting in a lot somewhere for a while, because when we did pull up to the red carpet, the car wouldn't start again once we were dropped off. And there was a picture in the San Francisco Chronicle in the art section of three gentlemen in tuxedos and with white gloves pushing our limousine away from the red carpet because it wouldn't start. And that was kind of symbolized the way that we showed up at the Oscars, really just by any means necessary and with all the resources we could muster.
That's a great story. Now, I understand you also recently directed a 44-minute documentary, which I haven't seen yet, Dreams, Cinema of the Subconscious, and that this was released on the Inception Blu-ray. Is your Dreams documentary available anywhere else? I'd like to see it.
You know, that's a good question. I did spend the last few months making this film. It was a fascinating project because I've been interested in dreams ever since I was a kid. And to have an excuse to talk to some of the leading experts in dream research is, you know, as you referred to about what Joseph Campbell said about following your bliss, it was such a treat and such a, an amazing thing for me to do because it's really been in me, that interest, for such a long time. So I don't know if it's available anywhere else. All I know is that it's on the Blu-ray of Inception, and I was hired to do that project. It's slightly different than Genghis Blues and Happy in the sense that I was hired on to direct a project that somebody else had conceived of for a very specific purpose. So I can't quite distribute it freely the way that I would films that we make on our own.
Yeah, I've had a long-standing interest in dreams myself and taught dream classes, and I have to say that I was really I didn't like Inception, and I actually walked out about three-quarters of the way through, and I feel like I'm in such a minority because most people really loved that film.
Well, people did love the film, and I absolutely was blown away by it. Now, Chris, the director, is a friend of mine, and so whenever I see his films, I don't know if I'm biased or not, but I grew up with him, and I understand, you know, the things that interest him are things that interest me as well.
Well, he made Memento, too, right?
Exactly.
And I love Memento.
Yeah. So he's extremely talented, and I think Inception. You know, most people that I know loved it, and a few people either didn't understand what was going on, or they just didn't think it was accurate to their experience of dreams. But you know, in a way, that's the whole point of dreams, is that they're extremely individualistic, and yet we all have them, so we can all relate on some level to other people's dreams, but we can never really get in the head of someone else in their dream. And in a way, that's what films to me are the closest. Just any film is about as close as it gets to sharing a dream. And so at least, you know, filmmaking and dreams are completely intertwined in my head. Mm-hmm. And I think Chris really wanted to explore that in a kind of extreme way and see what are the, you know, dramatic and plot potentials to make a film set almost entirely in the dream state.
Yeah, I'm going to need to rewatch it. You know, maybe my head just wasn't in the right place that time. So I can get that Blu-ray disc through Netflix, and I can watch your film, your short, and rewatch it and see if I can like it better the second time around. So now we should really talk about your newest documentary, which is called Happy the Movie. So tell us about that. How'd you get the idea for Happy?
Yeah, Happy. Genesis of Happy is really straightforward. Actually, a friend of mine named Tom Shadyac, who is a very successful Hollywood director of blockbuster comedies like The Nutty Professor and Bruce Almighty and Liar Liar, all of these huge Jim Carrey movies and Eddie Murphy movies. Looked in the New York Times one day, and there was an article about happiness, and it compared countries in terms of happiness. And it said, although America is one of the richest countries in the world, it's nowhere near the happiest. We were down at like number 25.
Yes.
And Tom, at the time, was living in a 17,000 square foot home on 14 acres, and he had literally dozens of people working for him. As gardeners and housekeepers and all of that, and he flew privately, and he really was living a very luxurious lifestyle, a kind of extreme version of the American dream. And he said that he was surrounded by friends and colleagues who were even more successful and more wealthy and more famous and more talented and better looking. You know, they had it all.
Yeah.
And he said, and some of them were really miserable, and some were just not any happier than you would expect a normal person to be. And it was very clear to him that it seemed that this increase in luxury just wasn't helping people get any happier, despite the fact that his colleagues and himself and most people he knew were still striving for more and more and more. And so so Tom called me, told me about the article, and said, look, I think we should explore this. You know, we've all heard the idea that money doesn't make you happier, and I know that to be true. But if it doesn't, then what does? And Happy, the movie, is the result of my 5-year journey exploring that subject.
Well, I recently saw Tom Shadyac's film, I Am, which is very inspirational. And I understand you had some role in producing that film, and he had some role in producing yours.
Exactly. So about 5 years ago, Tom said to me, let's make this movie on happiness. I don't know how to make documentaries. You do. So why don't you do it, and I'll pay you. I'll pay for it. I'll help you pay for whatever you need to do to make it happen. And I said, oh, you know, that as a documentary filmmaker, that's kind of a dream come true, especially when it's a subject that I've been interested in for a long, long time. So Tom is the executive producer on that film, Unhappy. And he also, of course, helped creatively. I would show him rough cuts of the film and get his opinion. And he's an extremely good storyteller, so he really helped shape the film. And then a couple years into the process, Tom decided he wanted to make his own documentary about something that was very important to him. And I shot I Am, that's Tom's documentary, I shot that with him over the course, on and off, for about a year, and then I think they edited for another a year or two. And indeed, now we have two documentaries. They're very kindred in spirit, although they're very different films. A lot of people have said they're kind of like sister films. Like, if you like one, you'll like the other. And I think that's very true.
And, you know, his title and your title make a sentence, I am happy. Was that deliberate?
Partially it was. I mean, we recognized that right off as soon as we were figuring out the titles, and we both thought that was cool, especially because the films do play well together. Mm-hmm. I've always thought that a double feature would be perfect, so that on the marquee it could say, I am happy, all in one line. I was just up in a theater at Corvallis, Oregon, where both films are playing, and that was really great to see, because it's kind of the closing of a circle that started about 5 years ago.
Oh, yeah, wonderful. I would love to interview Tom Shadyac as well, and I'm hoping I can get some contact info from you once we're off the air. I heard him speak at the premiere of I Am in Marin County, where I'm hoping your film will come as well. And I could have gone up and given him my card. My friend that I was with went up and talked to him, and I stupidly didn't think to do so at the time.
Oh, no problem, no problem. Yeah, I mean, Tom is extremely busy right now, as you can imagine.
Yes.
I think he's opened the film in over 100 cities so far, and he's been at as many of the screenings as he could. But I can put you in touch with the people that he works with, who can help figure out a time and if it's possible for him to do an interview. He's a great, amazing person.
Well, that's great. I would love that. And yeah, he came across that way on the stage when he made his remarks before and at the end of the movie. He's got a great sense of humor. He was very entertaining.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You mentioned the article that you read in the New York Times, and there's been a lot of research and writing in the field of psychology on happiness recently. Martin Seligman and others have been very active in what's come to be called positive psychology. So beyond that article that you read, did positive psychology or any of that literature or those people play a role in your interest in happiness?
Yes, absolutely. So when Tom suggested we make the film, first of all, agreeing to make a film, especially in my case, I know could be a multi-year commitment. So it was a big step. As soon as we took that step and said yes, I started looking online to see what information was out there, and I wanted to read the article again that Tom showed me. And I discovered immediately that there was this growing, fairly new field of science called positive psychology, and that a handful of people were pushing this forward through the research and the books they had written. And so I started reading books by Ed Diener and Martin Seligman mm-hmm. and Jonathan Haidt and Gregory Burns and Sonia Lyubomirsky. I was looking at her research at the time. She hadn't written a book yet. But a lot of fascinating research had been done fairly recently. And that was very exciting to me to recognize that we weren't only going to talk about happiness, but we're going to talk about this new insights that scientists were gaining into the study of happiness. So that became a kind of a skeleton for the project. I wanted to find the most fascinating discoveries in the field and then combine those with what I hoped would be emotional, personal stories so that the film could be a cinematic experience where you're really going on a journey and you're having an emotional experience. So that's what we did is we contacted as many of the researchers as we could who had done some fascinating work, and then set out to find the people whose lives would illustrate the findings. And that is a journey that took years to do. But yeah, finally we have a film called Happy.
Yeah. Now, were there any surprises for you along the way? I mean, you kind of knew what you hoped to be able to substantiate, but as you started encountering people in these other countries and profiling them, were there any surprises or personal discoveries?
There were. I guess, first of all, I should tell you that when Tom suggested making the film, I had a very strong and clear flashback to the first time I had been in Africa. I was 18 years old, and I was there with a group of college students who had raised money for refugees of the Mozambican Civil War. And we had headed down to a refugee camp just outside of Mozambique where people who had suffered through this war were struggling to survive. Now, these are people who had been terrorized. Some of them had their arms cut off, their lips cut off, their noses cut off, just horribly brutalized. And I was very prepared on that trip, or I was trying to prepare myself before going, to see extreme suffering and struggle and hardship, and I was trying to edify myself to be able to face that. And what I saw instead on this trip was people who were completely alive. They were vibrant, and they were enthusiastic, and they were curious, and they were laughing and dancing and smiling. And it totally blew me away that people who had struggled and suffered so much could have such a sense of, joie de vivre, such a sense of life and happiness. And, I immediately thought of some of my friends at home who would complain about things like not having, a new car for their 16th birthday, or weren't getting paid enough at their job, and something felt incongruous, and it was that raised the question in me, like the article, or like Tom's first experience having being in Beverly Hills, that raised the question in me: how could these people be so happy with so little? And so I wanted to tell that story. I wanted audiences who hadn't been to Africa, specifically to see refugees of a civil war, who hadn't seen that kind of suffering. I wanted to tell that story. And so that I was able to do, of course, because that story is all over the place. That story is not just in Africa or in war zones. It's everywhere. We told that story through a rickshaw puller in Calcutta, India, who lives in a slum and pulls a rickshaw, not a bicycle rickshaw, but pulls a rickshaw through the streets every day barefoot. But the surprises really came when I spoke with the scientists. When I spoke with Richard Davidson, and he told me about the effect of meditation, not only on a person's cognitive ability and emotional control ability, but physically on the brain, I was blown away. What he said was that a certain type of Tibetan Buddhist meditation that they had studied, called compassion and loving kindness meditation, was so powerful and effective that a person who had never done it before, having done it only for a couple of weeks, their brain, a certain part of their brain, would physically change in size. It would physically grow to an extent that they could measure with a ruler. And that was amazing to me. And that part of the brain specifically correlated with areas that are related to positive emotions, specifically the left prefrontal cortex and areas related to that. And that blew me away, that doing some meditation on compassion, in other words, practicing your ability to be compassionate and to care about other people, physically changed your brain. That was amazing.
Yeah, and you might be interested to know that I had the privilege of interviewing Richie Davidson on the same series.
Mm-hmm. Well, he is an amazing guy, and you know, again, back to the following your bliss concept. He's somebody who's really doing work that he loves, and it's clear that that's why he's finding out these amazing things, because he's really passionate, he cares about it, and he's interested, and the world is better because of it. You know, we're all lucky for Richie's work. But that was one of the things that blew me away. He also said that when he saw, for example, the effect of alcohol on people's brains, he stopped drinking. It's not that he ever was a heavy drinker. He just drank mildly, and he just thought, you know what, this doesn't look healthy, and he stopped. And similarly, when he saw the effects of physical aerobic exercise, he started riding his bike again.
Yeah.
And these are things that affected my life directly. I didn't realize at the time. I thought that I was already pretty happy, and I thought the key to happiness was simply being able to appreciate what you have, whether you're rich or poor or living in luxury or not. I didn't realize that there were these other components that I could affect of my own happiness with the conscious will. So I started surfing again after about 12 years of feeling that surfing was not very important, and it took a lot of time, and it took me away from my work, and it distracted me from promoting my career as an independent filmmaker, which is always a struggle. I listened to the social hum, which told me that surfing was irrelevant and just frivolous. But after talking to Richie Davidson, I realized it's not at all, and is an integral part of me feeling fulfilled and happy in my own life. And it's been a great gift to me. That one conversation I had with Richie has literally changed my life in that way. And I moved to a place near the beach.
Well, that's another one of those examples of something said, you know, that has an effect. I mean, as a teacher over the years, I've had students come up and express appreciation for something I had said in some lecture or presentation years before that I didn't even remember.
Right.
You know,
right.
And so, and probably all of us are sowing seeds that bear fruits that, you know, we don't know. We don't even know we're sowing the seeds some of the time.
I think most of the time we don't know, and I think that we're sowing them, and those seeds can grow into positive things or negative things.
Right.
And, you know, I've heard people tell me that somebody told them something very bad, a teacher who said, oh, you'll never be good at math, or you'll never be a good student. And that affected that person for decades afterwards in terms of damaging their self-esteem. So we are sowing these seeds, I agree with you, whether we know it or not, and they're positive or negative, whether we know it or not. Maybe they're both sometimes. But I really enjoy the idea that that so much of what we do is simply more important than we may have thought. Every interaction we have with a person is an opportunity to have an impact, positive or negative or neutral, you know, inspiring or discouraging or whatever, And that kind of ties into another bit of research that I really enjoyed hearing from Ed Diener, who's I consider to be kind of the godfather of happiness research, simply because he was doing it for so long when very, very few others, if anyone, was doing it. And I asked him if there was a single trait, a key to happiness. And, you know, I told him, I'm not looking for a soundbite. I'm just wondering if there is a single source. And he said, well, the formula is different for everyone. You know, some people need to go surfing and some people need to find time to read poetry. That's different. But the common thread among all happy people that he had ever studied in 30 years is that they had good relationships. It doesn't mean they had a lot of relationships. It doesn't mean that they were outgoing or they were the life of the party. But it meant that they had at least a few people who loved them and who they loved. And I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah.
It's something that our grandmothers have told us, you know, we kind of know it intuitively, but we're often encouraged to put friendships on the back burner and instead prioritize your job, for example. So it's easy to accept that somebody's going to move to another city because of a job promotion. But it's very rare that somebody moves to another city just because one of their friends lives there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I thought that was a real a clear indicator of how sometimes our priorities may be shifted a little bit, skewed away from things that will bring us happiness, and towards things that that simply create this illusion of happiness, like material wealth and comfort and luxury.
Well, you know, earlier you mentioned that African refugee camp, and you also mentioned the example of the rickshaw driver, which I got to see a clip of that on YouTube, a remarkable fellow. What would you say is the key to happiness in those situations that you observed?
Well, first of all, in both situations, among the refugees and with Manoj Singh and his family and his community, in both cases, there was a very, very strong sense of community. And in communal suffering comes bonding, it seems to be. And Manoj lives in a slum at the outskirts of Kolkata, which had just been moved, I guess, a couple months earlier. They had all these people, 200 families, were living under an overpass in the middle of Kolkata in a kind of really scummy, dirty area. But it was the only place they could go where people would leave them alone. And finally, they were not left alone, and the police made them move. And they simply marched until they found another spot they could settle down, and it was a vacant field on the outskirts of the city, which by the time I got there had open sewage ditches running in between these huts made from bamboo sticks and plastic tarps. But despite the material hardship, what was immediately apparent as soon as we set foot in there is that there was a very strong community. And it felt like as soon as we walked into this this community, everybody knew that there was somebody from the outside who was walking around. And they weren't defensive or aggressive. They just knew we were there. They were keeping an eye on us to make sure, you know, they wanted to check us out to see if we were going to do something, you know, positive or negative. And once they realized that we were there just to hear their stories. And I was actually there with a researcher who was collecting happiness data, a guy named Robert Biswas Diener. They welcomed us. And I immediately saw that the community that Manoj had around him was much stronger than the community I had in the neighborhood I lived in outside of San Francisco for 10 years. A community that was, you know, my neighborhood had houses built where the garage was in the front and everybody's lives were conducted in the house or in the backyard, whereas in Manoj's case, in this slum, the houses were so tiny, there were single little rooms, little huts, that everybody was sharing their life with everybody. And, you know, some people would say, oh my God, that sounds horrible, I need my space. And maybe that's true, but what it does mean is that they were there for each other, and they knew each other. And so when one person had a problem, there was five people who could volunteer to help. And that was something very beautiful, and I think is very directly related to the fact that Manoj could be happy. As a matter of fact, according to the research that was collected that day, he was exactly as happy as the average American, despite the fact that he didn't own shoes and didn't have a job that earned more than 20 cents a day and wasn't sure if he'd be able to pay for his child to eat the next week.
Well, I would say his face and bearing seemed much more radiant than the average American.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Manoj suffered too. You know, while we were there, he was sick one day, and he thought he was coming down with malaria, and he was so exhausted, despite the fact that he was accustomed to waking up at 4:30 in the morning and coming back at 6 in the evening. He's a very durable, rugged person, despite that fact, he stayed in bed one entire day because he felt so miserable. And what I learned the next day is that when he went to work the following day, his boss or the person who rented him a rickshaw was angry that he didn't show up and punished him by not allowing him to rent a rickshaw that day, meaning depriving him of yet another day's wages, which, as I mentioned, at 20, 25 cents a day was so minimal. You can imagine how quickly that could spiral into an unfortunate situation for Manoj. So he did suffer and he did struggle. And that's maybe something that's very important to say, you know, just because people have been through horrible experiences doesn't mean they don't suffer from that. But there is a sense of resilience that is normal to humans. I didn't realize that most of us have it, whether we know it or not. You know, many of us think, oh my God, if I lived through that, I wouldn't be able to survive. I wouldn't be able to take that.
Yeah.
But the truth is most people can survive and they can figure out a way to find a new perspective and find things to be grateful for and find ways to regain a sense of well-being.
Yes, well said, well said. By the way, do you know the novel Shantaram?
Yeah, I know it, and I have my friends are very big fans of it, and I have not read it yet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a wonderful novel, and it really captures life in that sort of slum. And and so I think you'd love it for that. And plus, it's just a good tale, and it's based on true events, more or less. So, do you have any ideas for what your next film project is going to be? Is that something you can talk about, or do you need to keep it under wraps?
I could talk about it if I knew what it was. There are a few projects. One actually relates to Genghis Blues. There's a fascinating book that was written by Richard Feynman's friend at the time, Ralph Layton. And Ralph is the person who told me about Paul Pina and basically told me the story of Richard Feynman, and he's the one I saw in the documentary when I was 16. And Ralph wrote a book called Tuva or Bust and has written a script based on that book. Fascinating story that Ralph is developing right now, and we're looking to see if that may be the next project.
Okay. Do you have any advice to any aspiring filmmakers out there?
Yes. Frequently, people who say they want to make films, both young and old, ask me what they can do. And the one hurdle that I see that really separates people who do it from people who don't do it is simply their unbending desire and sincerity to just do it by any means necessary. And I don't mean, of course, committing crimes to get your movie done, but I mean the people who just say, I'm going to do this whether I get funding or not, whether I get a famous actor or not, whether I find a wonderful script or if I have to write it myself, the people who just say, I'm going to do it by hook or by crook, those are the ones who end up succeeding. And so there are many ways to feel discouraged about filmmaking. You know, if you compare your movie to The Dark Knight, for example, you may feel like you'll never be able to compete with something so big and you know, amazing and cinematic. But I guess the key is to simply do something that you can do. Find a story you can tell, that you can shoot with your home video camera or even your phone, and just do it. And the more you practice, the better you'll get. I mean, that's one sure thing, is you're not going to get any worse by making films. Even if the films are terrible, you're always going to learn from it. And so really, what I really want to say is just do it. It's just like the Nike ad.
Yes, right.
Just do it. That's a simple truth. Most people who want to make films will not become filmmakers simply because they didn't make their first film. Once you make one, and in my case, again, I sort of felt like I did it when I was 6 years old, so I feel very lucky, even though I didn't. It wasn't my movie. But once you get over the psychological hurdle that you can do it, that opens up a kind of a plethora of opportunities and possibilities, and it gets all the creative juices flowing. And I really think that's the way to do it, is not to wait for anybody else's blessing or for funding to come in or anything. Just figure out what you can do and do it.
Well, Rocco, I hope that you keep just doing it for some time to come and keep blessing us with your creative filmmaking. And I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, I'm very grateful to you for giving me the opportunity to speak today. It was a great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Well, as you can see from my interviews with Rupert Isaacson, producer of the Horse Boy movie, and now with Rocco Bellick of Happy, Shrink Wrap Radio is breaking new ground with interviews touching on the world of film, and with an Oscar nominee at that. I'd also include my recent interview with Temple Grandin, who was the subject of an HBO feature film by the same name. Rocco was kind enough to forward my email invitation to the people who work with Tom Shadyac of IM, so I'm keeping my fingers crossed that we may snag him as well. I strongly urge you to see all of these very inspirational films, The Horse Boy, Temple Grandin, and Genghis Blues, and they're all currently available on Netflix. Rocco Bellick's Happy has not shown up in my area yet, but I'm really looking forward to seeing it. Personally, I'm thrilled that there are such committed and idealistic artists as Bellick, Shadyac, and Isaacson in the world of film. I think we all need as much inspiration as we can get, and these guys have really delivered.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long, just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
Hi, everyone. Well, here I am again, getting out yet another episode. I'm trying to get ready to go to the IPPA, the International Positive Psychology Association World Conference number 2 in Philadelphia. And so certainly this interview with Rocco Bellick was very relevant, and I thought I'd get that out before I go. And I certainly hope I'm not overloading you with too much content. You know, I used to do these once a week, and then I decided to cut back to every other week because of the wise counsels that I was doing as well. And 6 a month just felt like too much, so cutting back to every other week meant that I was doing more like 1 podcast a week. But I'm so fanatical about this, I guess, that I was working ahead, and I got way ahead. I've got a bunch of interviews, and I hate to keep my guests waiting, you know, for their interview to finally come up and be on the web. So I'm getting them out for a while now at 1 a week. So, hope I'm not overloading you, but I did want to get this one out before the conference. I haven't seen the movie Happy yet, but I understand it's going to be shown at this conference that I'm attending. I don't know if I'll see it at the conference or if I'll wait for it to come to my local area. I understand it'll be coming into this area in September. And at these conferences, there are always multiple things going on at the same time, and one has to make choices. So I don't know if I'll choose to see the film at the conference or not, or wait and see it with my best friend when it comes into this area. Now, speaking of wise counsel, my interview with Dr. Kristen Neff, who's at the University of Texas, Austin, it's finally up on the wisecounselpodcast.com, and our discussion is about self-compassion. Yeah, she is, among other things, in addition to being a psychologist, she's also a longtime Buddhist practitioner. And so she's carved out of her interests and practice of Buddhism a whole research area within psychology on self-compassion, which is becoming its own topic. So I know that's a topic that many of you will be interested in. I've been receiving invitations, some from some of you as well as other people in my life, to join Google Plus. I'm in Google Plus. I did join it. I have no idea how to use it or what to do with it. I don't know how people find so much time to be involved in social networking. I'm supposedly retired, and I can't seem to find much time to be involved in social networking. As you know, I use Facebook and Twitter primarily to announce new episodes. And I hear from people on Facebook that evidently prefer to communicate via email within Facebook rather than traditional email, and that's an interesting shift that seems to be going on. So I'm already in Google Plus, but it doesn't give you a way to, when somebody invites me, it doesn't give me a way to like be in Google Plus and see that person. I just haven't figured it out yet. I don't know if I'll find time to do that or not. But if somebody wants to give me a tutorial, I'm open to that, I guess. Let me remind you that if you need CE units, continuing education units, that there are two APA accredited courses where you can earn those units by listening to these podcasts. One is a course on the wisdom of the dream, and the other is on positive psychology and the quest for happiness. And I hope to be getting some more together. I think the next one I'm going to be working on is going to be on Jungian psychology, because as you know, that's been kind of a theme of late, the Jungian interviews and the positive psychology interviews seem to be two themes that I've been following. I just go where my nose leads me, and hopefully it will keep leading me to interesting places. Now, please do help to promote Shrink Wrap Radio. Our numbers go up and they go down. They were up, and now they seems like the subscriber number has gone down a bit, maybe because we're in the summer. That's what I like to think, is that maybe the students have gone home and and are into summer activities rather than listening to Shrink Wrap Radio. I really don't know what to make of it. But I'm always hoping to grow the audience, and I look to you for your help in doing that. So if you have a website or a newsletter or a blog, please help to promote it. And I have a subscription to Giga Alerts, where Google alerts me. I just do it at the free level. So if it's ranked high up, I'll hear about it sometimes when people do promote the show or it gets mentioned somewhere. And so as a result of Giga Alerts, I saw a wonderful mention in a blog that's titled Gratitude Every Day, What I'm Thankful For. And that's the title of the blog. And what a great idea for a blog. And I don't even know who the person is. There's no identification that I could see on the blog that tells me the name of the blogger. But evidently that blogger is a listener to Shrink Wrap Radio, and I'm going to subscribe to that blog. I indicated that I put myself on their subscription list. And I'm grateful for that blogger and for their mention, because here's what they posted on their blog for July 12th. Today, I'm grateful to Dr. David Van Nuys, the author of Shrink Wrap Radio podcast, available for free from this website, and there's a link there to Shrink Wrap Radio, and from iTunes. I've recently realized that I've been listening to it for over 3 years now. It's never boring. It covers all aspects of psychology, from business management to spirituality. The latest podcast with Jerry Trumbull about the slippery slope of reality and hypnagogia were especially fascinating. So, mystery blogger, thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it. And let me remind you all once again to please become a donor. As you know, I put a lot of energy, time, effort, and even expense into producing this content. And I see lots of people that are putting their content behind closed doors where you have to become a subscriber to even see it. And I continue to obsess and wonder if I should be doing something along those lines. And I would rather not. Just the cost of attending this conference, for example, probably wipes out the last 2 or 3 years' worth of donations. There are only a handful of people who have committed to donating at the $10 a month level. And I really think that the value is there and would really plead with you to consider joining at whatever level you can. Just look for that big green donate button in the right-hand sidebar. And thank you in advance.
Hi, I'm Russ Harris, author of The Happiness Trap, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Russ Harris, who will be my guest on our next episode. Once again, I'm running a bit long, so I'll just read a couple of recent emails. First, we hear from Jose in North Carolina, and Jose writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave, you have a great show going, and I admire all the hard work you've put into it. I'm just starting a psychology-themed talk show in Chapel Hill called Psych Talk," and he gives the link as http://psychtalkradio.com. Psych Talk Radio? Shrink Wrap Radio? Maybe I've been an inspiration. He goes on to say, "Are you comfortable with an amateur, non-commercial radio show like mine quoting you or your guests from your podcasts? There are various short clips from your shows that I would love to be able to play without modification and with full attribution to you and your guest. Thank you." That's from Jose Lopez, Psych Talk Radio host, Princeton class of 2013. So I guess you haven't graduated yet, Jose. You must be a sophomore. And that makes me wonder, well, what are you doing in Chapel Hill? Maybe you live in Chapel Hill when you're not at Princeton. So I did give Jose permission to do quotes with attribution. That's a real compliment, and I'm happy to support it. And that's just one of the ways that Shrink Wrap Radio helps to serve the world and to get out there. So thanks for your help. It's mutually beneficial. Next, we hear from Anthony, who posted the following in the comments area of our transcripts page. And he wrote, "Dr. Dave, first of all, thank you for putting in the hard work on your side for making this all happen. It has opened up my mind in a way that I have answers where there were questions before. Your guests are very informative. Your questions are probing and illuminating. Moreover, the quality of content is so important in a world which is saturated with information. So keep up the good work, Anthony." Thanks for that, Anthony. And yes, boy, talk about information overload. There is so much content out there. So I'm especially gratified that there are those of you who have chosen, with all the content that's available, that you've chosen to come back again and again to Shrink Wrap Radio. So that better wrap it up for today. Send me your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, or you can leave a message on Skype where I'm ShrinkPod, or even on my phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to Rocco Bellick for giving us the background on his new film, Happy the Movie. I'm hoping I'll get to meet him in person at the Positive Psychology Conference in Philadelphia. On the next episode, my guest will be Russ Harris, MD, from Melbourne, Australia. He was suggested by a listener, and we'll be discussing his provocatively titled book, The Happiness Trap, the title of which would seem to run counter to this whole positive psychology movement that I've been exploring. So tune in to see if it does or not. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.